Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome writer Lucy Lepard and photographer Edward Ranney. Their new book is called Down Country, The Tano of the Galisteo Basin, 1250 to 1782, and they will be speaking in a panel discussion and book signing at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture on Sunday, this coming Sunday, June 13th at 3 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
There's also an event that we'll talk about later that's happening in Galisteo, which is coming up in a few weeks. So this is a book about the Tano people, or southwestern Tewa, who lived in what is now Galisteo Basin. Lucy, why did you take on this subject? Who are these people?
Well, they're actually the southern Tewa. They're a split off at some point, nobody knows quite when, from the Tewa of the Tewa Basin north of Santa Fe, the Santa Clara, San Ildefonso, San Juan, and so forth, Okeawinge, and so forth. And I took it on really inadvertently because I wanted to write a book about the Galisteo Basin, and I looked for the history of it, and the history of it didn't exist. And I thought this very weird. This is this famous place about which nothing much seems to be known. Then I found that there's actually a fair amount known about it, but it's all sprinkled madly. I mean, sprinkled everywhere between lots and lots of books on lots of bits and pieces of archaeology and history and so forth. But nobody ever brought together either the Tano or the Galisteo Basin. And the Tano left the basin in 1782. It's a long story, which we'll be talking about. So they supposedly don't exist anymore. In fact, there are people who come back to the basin to do rituals and ceremonials and so on fairly often, and they're the descendants of the Tano, but some of them are at Hopi. There's Hopi Tewa Village, that's the Tano, some of the Tano. Some of them are no doubt still in the Tewa area, and when they left in 1782, they went down to Santo Domingo, which is a little odd because that's a Karis village, not a Tewa village. And some of them were in Pecos as well, and I think some of the Pecos people in Pecos closed in 1838, or vanished or whatever. Not vanished, terrible word, don't say that. Then some of them went to Domingo as well, probably to join the other people who were there. But the Tano were among the leaders of the Pueblo Revolt. And so they were the ones who lived in Santa Fe during that's 12, 13 years that the Spanish were kicked out. And so they were pretty well decimated when de Vargas came back, and they were scattered all over. That's another whole part of the story.
But
the Tano in sort of don't exist as a particular nation anymore, but they're all over the place. They did not vanish.
Why the starting point 1250?
Well, that's kind of a guess, and I ran it by all my archaeologist friends, and they said that would do it. I mean, nobody really knows exactly when they came into the Galisteo Basin.
Where did they come from?
Well, they probably came from the north, from where the Tewa villages were being founded up, and also the Pajarito Plateau, possibly, and the Chama Valley, which was about the same time, actually. People were in all of these places. It's a very complicated history, and I probably shouldn't just run it down because the book goes into a lot of stuff like this archaeologist says this and that archaeologist says that, and here's what they say.
Well, so, as much as anything else, the book is a compilation of exactly that, what so many different people say, which was really it must have been a huge process of putting this together. Some of the pieces are not even published. You had to find them all over the place.
Yes, I have a big thing against indexes now because I would go through where I started. I went through all the general books for references to the Galisteo Basin, and sometimes I read it and would read the whole book and find about 10 more Galisteo Basin references, and they weren't in the index. So all my books have Galisteo Basin index references written in, and so I'm very indexes should pay more attention.
So what was the land like then compared to the way it is now?
Well, certainly Lucy can speak more authoritatively on this than I can, but I believe in around 1250 there was a definite shift in the weather patterns which brought people to the Galisteo because it was a period in which, with the increased rainfall, corn could be grown fairly easily. And that lasted, what, Lucy, several hundred years?
Yeah, well, actually not that long, really, more like 100 or 150 years or something. But by the 1400s, there were already problems. But they had come, a lot of these people had obviously come east from the Chaco and Mesa Verde collapses, and Aztec and who knows what else. But there was also a population, at least some people think so, in the Rio Grande already. And the Tewa may have been in the Rio Grande already, or they may have come from the north, or they may have come from Mesa Verde, or even Chaco, which my Tewa friends did not want to come from Chaco.
Well, that brought up, this Chaco thing brought up something that was very interesting, which was in the book there are a lot of questions raised about how you tell stories, how you tell history, what your sources are. Do you look to mythology? Do you look to stories? And there was some kind of myth or legend or set of myths and legends that said that something ominous happened in Chaco, but nobody knows what it is anymore, but nobody wants to come from there because of that ominous thing that's been forgotten.
Well, that's the viewpoint of one particular group. But, I mean, we have to realize that history is our myth and our legend. I mean, our histories are, you know, maybe more based in what we call fact, but the Pueblo histories and the Pueblo stories are much more multivocal, sort of. I mean, they as I think Tessie Naranjo says, I quote her in the book, she says something like, you know, we believe all the stories, and Westerners tend to go for the one story. You know, got to have the story, and my book is guilty of that as any. I mean, although I do have a lot of stories that all the archaeologists are coming up with.
So it is an important and interesting thing to contemplate, and that's not the major part of what the book is about, but it underlies it, which is archaeology is a relatively new field of study, and it's one way of knowing. History is one way of knowing. And the stories that Pueblo people themselves tell are yet another. Mm-hmm. And this is all of these are things that you try to bring together.
Mm-hmm. And we don't recognize multiple truths in Western history and philosophy. I mean, it has to be one or the other, or it's not right, or so forth. So, and that is not the way a lot of the world thinks. And in a funny way, postmodernist theory gets into that and pushes at the edges of that single truth business. Because history, as they're always saying, is the story of the victors, and it's written by the victors, not by anybody else.
Except for Howard Zinn and
well,
a few
yes.
people like that.
Well, Howard Zinn was a victor too, thank goodness.
Let's talk a little bit more about the land. So this the early period of the Tano people here in our own area, the Galisteo Basin, you had a relatively wet period. They started growing corn and probably some other things too. What was life like? It was a farming way of life?
Yeah, it was farming. I mean, this wet period did allow the farming to be more successful than it turned out to be later, because the Galisteo Basin was dry, period, and it took this wet period to get people into the basin. And then when the wet period went away, it was still a dry place. And when you live there, I think I say, you really feel that, because especially now, we haven't had real rain in Galisteo for 2 months. And you see the clouds gathering around the mountains around the edge, and you really understand the Pueblo worldview, because you sit there doing whatever you can to bring them over, and they go right around the mountains, and off they go. And it's very depressing. Kind of what a friend of mine calls coitus interruptus, the virga, where you get the clouds and the rain coming down and they don't ever get to the earth and so forth. And it was a dry place for most of the time the Tano were there, or a lot of the time.
What were the interactions among the various peoples of that area like? I mean, you describe that there's some trade and there's also some kind of spiritual ceremonial sharing.
Yeah, well, the people, it wasn't just the Tano in the basin, the Karis, and nobody really knows how far out of the basin the Tano went. And the Karis were at San Marcos, which is where I draw my Galisteo Basin line. Some people have included La Cienega in the Galisteo Basin. I didn't, because it's not in the Galisteo Basin, but it certainly is. It may have been Tano as well. Pa'aco, which is down on 14, when you past the Ortiz Mountains, that may have been Tano at one point. They often, Pueblo people at that point, are often settled then on maybe a very small settlement to begin with, and conditions, resources might have gotten scarce, and they'd go away for a while, they'd come back, build more buildings. It was a very intermittent kind of thing. They built their these huge pueblos. Some of these pueblos have well, somebody suggested up to 4,000 rooms, but they're usually about at least 1,500 to 2,000 or so.
Yeah. Can you tell how many people live there from
that? Probably with that many rooms, about 500 people. With 2,000 rooms, around 500 people. Is that what you...
Well, my understanding is that the whole pueblos weren't occupied at the same time.
Yeah, exactly.
So there was waves of habitation, larger densities at certain times and more than others. And shifting between the pueblos as well.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't some people move back and forth?
Right, right. And we don't really have a way to chart all of that. The archaeologists do it with ceramics, which are, it's fine, and that's the major way of telling, but it doesn't seem to tell a whole hell of a lot when you get down to it, I think.
Right.
What's extraordinary, though, is that with the exception of a few room blocks that are left from the early excavation of Nels Nelson from the Museum of Natural History in New York, which his excavations were
1912 to 15.
Mm-hmm. With the exception of a few exposed walls and above surface structures, there's very little to indicate how dramatically dense the structures were in terms of Pueblo organization.
We're talking to Lucy Lepard and Edward Ranney about the book Down Country, The Tano of the Galisteo Basin. Now, there are a lot of petroglyphs there, and the petroglyphs are evidence of Kachina culture. Tell us about Kachina culture. What are Kachinas?
They are deities that live on the tops of mountains associated with clouds and water. And interestingly, the kind of iconography that you find in the rock art in the Galisteo Basin is not reflected in current Tewa ceremonial life, so that there's a lot of people really disagree about when the Kachina came in. Some people say around 1300, 1325. Other people think it's 100 years later. Came into the eastern part, whether it originated somewhere near there, whether it originated in the Mogollon, whether it originated in the western pueblos. There's still an awful lot of disagreement about all of this stuff.
Well, what do we know? What are the images that we see in these petroglyphs? How were they used? What do they mean? Do we know?
We know a little bit. Or I know a little bit, I really should say. My favorite image is the cloud terrace, which is a stepped terraced sort of building, and that comes in all kinds of fascinating varieties. There are birds on top of cloud terraces. There are cloud terraces with bird heads. There are cloud terraces with faces, and there are cloud terraces with rainbows, and there are cloud terraces with rain coming down underneath them. And that's one of the major images that you find in the Galisteo Basin. There's a lot of Kachinas who represent certain things which were foggier on as to what they... serpents, horned serpents, which probably were Mesoamerican originally. Polly Schaffsma, who's the expert on this from my money, brings in the resemblances to the Tlaloc, which is a Mexican deity with big eyes, and she finds that in the Galisteo Basin. It's a water deity. And there's a wonderful... At Pueblo Blanco, there's marvelous zigzag kind of bodied horned serpent. It's about, 15, 18 feet long or something. And then down below it, on a rock off of the bench that it's... the sandstone bench that it's on is a smaller but quite impressive one that's coming, snake with horned serpent, that's coming out of a pot. And then this goes back to a Hopi ritual that was written up in the early 1900s, late 1800s. So there's a connection there. The snake coming out of the pot is part of something that happened in the Kivas of Hopi.
And do we know how this spirituality, how the system functioned in people's lives?
Well, I think it was dominant. I mean, it was a lot of it.
Sure. I mean, daily life revolved around certain kinds of ceremonies that were important to keep the pueblo and the culture within the strictures of the natural universe.
I mean, it struck me when I was reading it that there's probably not the same kind of boundaries that we have between the natural world and the spirit world, that they were continuous.
Oh, yeah, they were one and the same, really. Yeah. I mean, don't you think that's fair to say?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And water, of course, which we all know and we're all too aware of now, was always the main thing. I mean, without water, there was no life, and they certainly knew that very well. And they did extraordinary farming techniques. I mean, people have written about how amazingly subtle the agricultural techniques were. They managed water to the last drop, sort of little tiny brush dams, little rivulets here. They scattered their farming all around so that they had a better chance if the droughts were really bad. This little patch of ecosystem might nurture something, and that one might go. And it's fascinating. I don't know that much about farming, but they clearly
well. And they also built significant reservoirs to hold water from the rainy season.
Right.
So a few remnants of those are still visible. But.
Is this the kind of thing that people are studying to learn from as we leave our wet cycle, apparently, if that's what we're doing right now?
Yeah, Greg Cahete, he has written a book. I think he and Vivi Price have written together. No, he and Kurt Anschutz, I think, have worked. No, I guess it's just his book anyway, has written about the kind of, with permaculture people. I know Kurt Anschutz, who's an archaeologist, has worked with contemporary Pueblo farmers and the permaculture framework is very familiar to the Pueblo people.
We're talking to Lucy Lepard and Edward Ranney about the new book, Down Country, The Tano of the Galisteo Basin, 1250 to 1782, which, by the way, is published by the Museum of New Mexico Press. Don't want to forget that. So here you have these people living, and they were not alone in this part of New Mexico, and there was trade, and there was this Kachina spirituality, and there was farming, and so on. At a certain point, the Spanish show up and make life miserable for everybody.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, a lot of the Spanish, of course, were poor people who were also looking for some place to live and so forth. So but the leaders were certainly making trouble. Well, they were already in the 1540 or so, 40, 41, when Coronado first came through. There was already a very hard time in the Galisteo Basin and because of drought and resources and so forth. So the Pueblos in the basin were already on a sort of downturn by the time the Spanish showed up. And also the diseases had already probably come up from Cortez's earlier 1500s.
Oh, that's so interesting. The diseases preceded the people
exactly.
through others who'd had contact with them just through trade.
Right. And, I mean, these diseases were lethal to Indian people. I mean,
smallpox and other things.
Yeah, and just everything. Measles and things that might not have been lethal to Europeans killed off masses of native people. So they were already in a slightly vulnerable position when the Spanish came. And there's all this business about how did the Spanish, with 60 people or something, vanquish a whole Pueblo. What is rarely mentioned, and which the Richard and Shirley Cushing Flint bring up in their books on Coronado, is that they had with them these large armies, 1,000 or more people, who were called Indios Amigos, which are Mexican Indians who came with the Spanish. And that was, they had a real force there, and also Indians who knew something about other Indians and so forth, and were probably. So it wasn't, the Spanish weren't quite so magic as it sounds, they just walked in and took over.
One thing that is striking is the extent to which they wanted not only people's stuff and their land and so on, but they had this apparently visceral hatred of the local religion, of this idolatrous religion, and it reminded me of the way some people feel about snakes or about germs or something, or about cockroaches. They wanted to destroy it, and succeeded in doing so to some extent. I mean, we have some objects, some artifacts that were hidden. We have some artifacts that are in museums and so on. But a lot of them were just wiped out. Where did this intense need to destroy these people's way of life, and as particularly their spirituality, where did that come from? Do you have any sense of that?
I think it's very typical of institutional religion myself. I mean, I don't think it's quite so rare. It goes on today.
You see it all throughout ancient America, Peru, Mexico.
Yeah.
It happened in a large sort of wave to eliminate any kind of resistance. I mean, basically any kind of idolatry, as it was called, was a form of resistance.
Which it indeed was.
I mean,
Ed's worked a lot in Peru, so he knows that part of it. But that came in, too, when the missionaries came with almost all of these expeditions, and it was the missionaries who were zealous, as missionaries are supposed to be, as missionaries still are today. who did a lot of that destruction or demanded the destruction and so forth. There were probably a few of the friars who were somewhat sympathetic. And they never gave them a chance. They never were at one pueblo once they'd missionized, starting in the early 1600s. They were never at a pueblo long enough, or very rarely, to learn the language and to understand the people at all. So they were really lousy at their jobs, because the resistance did grow, because there was no understanding coming from them at all, I don't think.
So what happened to the Tano people during this fairly long period that you cover in the book, between the arrival of the Spanish and the time they left the Galisteo Basin?
Well, they suffered under it, they suffered under it for about 80 years, under 82 years, if you want to be exact, from Oñate's original settlement. The Spanish didn't really get into the Galisteo Basin until the early 1600s and start missionizing and building churches and so on. But they were already sort of, the friars were poised. They had pueblos they were supposed to be taking care of from Oñate from 1598 on. And they put up with the villains were probably less the vecinos than the governors, who were tended to be really greedy creatures when you look at them. I mean, a few of them had some sense, but most of them were just there. They went to New Mexico on their own dime, which was the royal crown had to allow them to do it, but they had to give them permission to do it. In fact, one Casano de Sosa, he came without permission, and he was arrested and taken back, and he didn't. And he was one of the sort of kinder conquistadores. But the governors and the original explorers all paid for themselves. But the Spanish crown sort of got a lot out of it. So it was not a wonderful system. And so they exploited the Tano and all the other pueblos as much as they possibly could to try to get them to weave enough mantas to send back, and they had the tribute was quite large, but they had to work for the Spanish, and then they had to work for themselves to get themselves fed. So they were doing double work. When the Spanish first came in, the pueblos usually had several years' worth of dried corn and so forth for bad use, because they knew the bad use would definitely be coming, and the Spanish just saw these as surpluses, and so they took as much of it as they could, so leaving the pueblos in sort of bad shape too. It was not a good situation, and finally it was so bad that they revolted. But the vecinos were, you know, poor people who'd come up to make their thing, so it's always, as in any war, it's the poor people fighting the poor people. I mean, the exploited fighting the exploited and so on for the benefit of a few other souls.
Let's talk about the photographs. It's full of black and white photographs of this area, of some of these sites, of petroglyphs and so on. Why did you choose black and white?
Well, black and white is sort of the medium I've been using since the mid-60s, really. And it involves looking at a spectrum of tones that really are more abstract than you see in color photography, and that's one aspect of it that appeals to me a great deal, that even though these are very realistic images, I think O'Keefe said it once, that if something isn't well put together in an abstract way, it's not a very well-conceived image, and I see photography that way, as abstracted reality, you might say, and I don't sort of overemphasize that. But at the same time, it's a question of making sure when you work with black and white that you eliminate the distractions that might step in and keep you from really focusing on what I'm trying to present.
And I knew Ed's work because we'd actually met in New York a long time before that, because I'd written a book that had some prehistoric stuff in it, and he was a friend of Cesar.
Yeah.
Tell you, yeah. Cesar Paranosto, who'd worked in Latin American stuff, and he knew Ed's work and sent him to see me at one point. So when I came down here, I like black and white too. I'm particularly fond of black and white. I'm not as articulate about it as Ed is, but I chose Ed because of his black and white archaeological photographs and landscapes.
This project interrelated extremely well with work I've been doing for 40 years in Peru, especially working with ancient ruins, first the Inca structures around Cuzco and throughout the highlands. And then more recently, over the last 25 years, I've been photographing coastal ruins up and down the Andean coastal region. And those sites are more sort of rudimentary and almost eroded than other ones are. So that body of work, the coastal work, relates very strongly to the kind of landscape that's up here, where in a specific area like the Galisteo, the ruins are not dramatic, such as Chaco Canyon or Mesa Verde, but they're ruins that you can see them or you can intuit kind of how the structures fit into the landscape, but only with a certain kind of sixth sense, you might say.
Yeah, I was thinking there's such a necessity for imagination when you do this kind of work, because you go out on that land, which you, Lucy, were drawn to and have lived on for quite a while, and people call it empty or uninhabited, and you feel and see something else, and you really have to bring that to it. You both do.
Right.
And, yeah, and Ed's lived in the Western Basin for longer than I've been in the Eastern Basin and so on. But also people, you say, oh, I'm going to take you to a Pueblo ruin. They get all excited, you know, and then but they get out there. They get out there, and there's just these mounds of dirt with cholla growing all over it. And then they're like, yeah, so where's the ruin? And,
right.
And they're used to reconstructed ruins. The only actual standing ruin in the Galisteo Basin is the church or the mission chapel at San Cristobal. And that was, archaeologists have just determined recently that wall that's standing, which is the apse of the chapel, was stabilized at some point in the 19th or 20th century, so it wouldn't ordinarily, it would have been a pile of rocks otherwise.
The sites that you were looking at and the entire area that this book covers, what's going on with the land now? It's owned by, is any of it public land or Indian land, or is it all private?
Well, we should mention something called the Galisteo Basin Archaeological Sites Protection Act, which was put through Congress, I think, several years ago, but it wasn't appropriated until a couple of years ago. And there's a committee of archaeologists who've been trying to protect these 24 sites, which are in and also outside of the Galisteo Basin, but all of the ones that I talk about are pretty much in there, including one of the two crestons, which are the hogbacks with extraordinary petroglyphs on it. So this is an agreement that was supposed to preserve all of these places, and Domenici kind of took the backbone out of it by saying that the landowners didn't have to work with it if they didn't feel like it. So out of the 8 major pueblos in the Galisteo Basin, and there are 2 or 3, 4, whatever, others that aren't called the 8 major pueblos, the classic pueblos, how many are on San Cristobal?
I think they're
San Cristobal, Largo, Colorado, Shea.
3 or 4.
Four plus millions of other sites and amazing petroglyph sites are all on the San Cristobal Ranch. And so the singletons who own that have a huge amount of power in terms of whether this. And then there's one that's owned by the state, one site that's owned by the county, the Petroglyph Hill on Route 42 between Galisteo and Surios. And that is pretty much it. The State Land Commission owns Pueblo Blanco. And then the Archaeological Conservancy has easements, owns one and has easements on the Galisteo Pueblo. It has an easement on the San Marcos. It owns a chunk of it. But none of these sites, which is why I'm bringing this up, we spend a lot of time. I sit in on this committee. I'm not on it, really. I just sit there. But a lot of these sites are so much bigger than the little things that the Office of Archaeological Studies, which Eric Lindman heads, have been able to contract people to survey and the very specific boundaries, because it's a federal act, it has to be very specifically done. But it's so ridiculous to cut off a pueblo from its landscape, because these landscapes were what were important to people. I mean, the pueblos were just sort of where they lived, in a way. I mean, there were shrines in the center of the pueblo, shrines here, shrines there, further and further out, in sort of concentric circles. But the landscape itself, it's almost impossible to protect it. I mean, everybody realizes you can't say, okay, we're going to do the whole Galisteo Basin, we'll be protected and preserved, and nobody can do anything there. I would love to see that happen, but needless to say, it's not. And we're fighting all the time, like with the recent Saddleback Ranch Estates, which is a big subdivision coming in right next to the Galisteo Pueblo. And next to makes no sense, because it's part of the Galisteo Pueblo. There's sites all over there, and they're going to put multi-million-dollar mansions on top of them or around them. I mean, there's this archaeological thing going on to survey it and not have the houses built exactly on top of the archaeological sites, but it's all site. it isn't just, there's a terrific emphasis on material culture, which means the building, where they find the stuff. But in fact, for Pueblo people, the landscape was every bit as important, and they're not half as embroiled in this material culture thing, except for human remains, burials is hugely sensitive stuff. But it's the entire landscape obviously overlapped in different times. It meant different things to these pueblos. The different pueblos may have been sort of dormant at a time when another one was really rising up. And maybe part of that first one's landscape became part of the second thing. Then things change, and landscape changes along with the meanings of the landscape change too. And the rock art offers a great many clues to that. And the shrines that are all over the place, and many of which we probably don't know about and don't recognize as shrines, because they're not into like great big monumental stuff. The smallest kind of thing can be a shrine, and traces of something that we would never even notice. So the whole notion of the cultural landscape, which J.B. Jackson, a wonderful cultural geographer from New Mexico, who lived in Los Cienegos, probably the most influential writer on the cultural landscape that's been around. He died years ago, but he was a huge influence on me and many other people. That thinking that way in terms of relationships between places as much as the place itself is really important to this kind of study.
Well, I think it's also significant that, at a time when everybody is increasingly interested in what these sites look like, even the landscape, one wonderful aspect of them being sites being held in private hands is it is private property. Yep. And for instance, San Cristobal Ranch can really protect the major sites there. And the other thing is that hopefully that with a book like this, the evidence, the visual evidence of what these places look like should be very clear, and that there isn't a great sort of hidden Machu Picchu or someplace like that for people to go prowl around and find stuff. As most people, as Lucy intimated earlier, are pretty disappointed when they actually come to an area that they think is supposed to be a pueblo because it's just landscape. And hopefully the impact of the photographs in this book will give people a sense of the landscape and what it feels like to be there without having to go there, without having to trespass and enter into sort of all the legal ramifications of that.
You describe Lucy Lepard looking for petroglyphs and crawling into little places on your back and looking up and seeing these things, and it's really been a process in itself, I think, for you, probably for both of you, of getting to know this land on foot in an intimate manner.
Very much so. I mean, I've been a great advocate of walking for a long time for many different aspects of what my work has been, and poor Ed has to walk with this giant thing on his back.
I use a view camera, 5x7-inch.
Oh my goodness!
And it's really a instrument out of the past two centuries, not just the 20th century, but the 19th century. And it's what for me makes the whole experience of working in the landscape a very rewarding one, because you see things very differently than you do with a digital or even a 35mm camera. And it emphasizes again the structure of the image. Not only the tonal, fine-grained aspect of the print, but it gives you a totally different sense of what the landscape is all about. And I've gotten used to hauling it around, but I can only go certain distances, not quite as far as Lucy wants often.
Yeah, come on over here. climb up another Taylor slope.
How is it? Writing this massive book and bringing together so much history and archaeology and so on, and having that experience of life, how has it changed the way you are, your relationship to that place, the Galisteo Basin?
Well, obviously, you almost can't miss the layers in the Galisteo Basin if you just know a little tiny bit about it. I came there first to see Halley's Comet in the middle of the night, and I couldn't see anything, and people kept saying, "Oh, you'd like this place." And there are petroglyphs underfoot. So I knew about the layers before I ever even saw anything, because I couldn't see a thing except Halley's Comet, which was not very interesting. But it certainly changed. The minute you know where things have happened, it changes it. I wrote a book called The Lure of the Local, which was this is a product of that. I decided I should practice what I preached, which was you get to know your place really well, take the responsibility for knowing your place, and then take responsibility for what happens to your place, no matter how long you've lived there. I mean, locals obviously have more invested in it in some ways than people who've come more recently, but I came there first 23 years ago and into the basin, and Ed has been there forever. When did you come for?
Well, we found our place on the Upper San Marcos Arroyo in 1973, and it's a northern end of the basin, you might say. We look south to Cerro Pelon, which Lucy talks about in a very evocative way in the first chapter of the book. And it's just a landscape to me in which I feel totally at home. That's why my family and I have lived there for as long as we have.
But it is fascinating. I did a walk for the O'Keeffe Museum. They do this Walk in the West series, and about, I don't know, 10 people or something, and we went up to the top of part of the Galisteo Basin Preserve, which is part of the Commonwealth project. And we stood up there on a ridge, and you could see the east of the basin and the west of the basin, and then I sort of told the history. And people really said, I mean, I thought, they're never going to get this. I'm pointing over there and saying, like, over there is such and such, and over here the Spanish came in, and over there there's a pueblo. And it's just this gorgeous landscape. But people, apparently, one person told me, and I was really moved by this, she said, I'm going to get that book, and I'm going to go up on that ridge, which is a public trail, and I'm going to read the book up there so I can look and see where everything took place. And that's sort of a lovely idea. I mean, it was
well, the nice thing about a comment like that is that it reaffirms what I feel, and you probably do too, in terms of when you're out in these places, what results for you is being able to carry the landscape in your head, almost in a map form, mm-hmm. so that you're totally without any sort of distraction or confusion about what is where and what it means and what the relationships are between different formations and sites.
Yeah, I think for people who get a chance to see this book or to buy it or to even just to hear the interview and then to go there would deepen it a great deal, because I was sitting here trying to, you know, reading the book yesterday and trying to imagine all of these places and get a feel for it and what people's lives
are
like.
Well, I recommend the Galisteo Basin Preserve trails. I think they're about 14 miles now, but eventually they're going to be about 60 miles. But one thing I have to emphasize is that we've all been guilty, I think, of picking up a shard here and there. And
Don't do that.
You're absolutely not supposed to do it, but I finally stopped for once and for all when I was at one of the little Pueblo sites with Rina Swensel and Tessie Naranjo and an archaeologist. And one of them found a shard, a little tiny thing, and they picked it up and we all looked at it. And he said, my God, that probably takes the history of this place back 100 years. And all of a sudden I realized, oh my God, you know, if I had taken that one little shard home, as so many people do, and as I once did myself, I might as well admit it, I think that there's very few people in New Mexico who haven't taken home a shard now and then, but it really is detrimental to the archaeology, and you could be taking home that one clue, and that would really be frightening to think you'd erased a big chunk of history with this little tiny thing that once you get in your house doesn't really mean much anyway. So.
Well, and a lot of the artifacts from, as you describe in the book, from this area have been, still exist, but without their context, they're
exactly,
more or less meaningless.
Yeah, and the whole, I mean, actually Nelson was sort of invented stratification, or he gets credit for being one of the inventors of stratification.
What is stratification?
In the Galisteo Basin. Well, they used to just dig in the 19th century, and when they found stuff, they were happy, and they did so. And he, because he'd worked in shell heaps in California with another well-known archaeologist, he realized that these things came in layers, and when you found this in the top layer, it meant it was later. I mean, you know, it doesn't take a rocket science, but people hadn't really thought about that because they were mostly after the stuff that could be put in museums and so on. And he realized that you could learn a great deal more about the people and how they lived and everything by figuring out where one strata ended and another layer of occupation came in and so forth. And that's what archaeologists have done ever since. I mean, it's a huge, that's it. Sort of.
Well, the other wonderful thing about Nelson was that he was actually a very, very good photographer himself.
Yeah, and there's a bunch of photographs in the book.
Yeah, unfortunately, the way that they're printed with the text renders them hard to read. They're somewhat dark. and that's because they're done in halftone, just one pass of inking, as opposed to duotone. So they're hard to read, but they were all done, of course, with large format cameras at that time. And he had a very, very good sense of how to read the landscape visually with a camera. And in certain cases, you can actually compare some of my pictures with his, and it wasn't any intention of mine. It's just that there's a certain overlap that naturally occurs when you're looking at a specific site.
Or when someone with a really good eye is looking at a specific site.
And you can see the dramatic changes in the landscape between 1912 and 15 and just a few years ago.
And also just from his notes, like he mentioned in Galisteo Pueblo, in the Galisteo Pueblo ruin, there was no choya. I remember we took our dog out there years ago, and there was so much choya we had to carry our 40-pound dog around the whole time because he just couldn't walk without getting choya. And so there's some kind of condition has made that a choya-covered pueblo, which it wasn't at all, and so forth. So it is. I mean, ecologically, it's interesting too, which I haven't gotten.
Well,
into.
Invasive species such as the juniper too. There's much more juniper than there used to be.
Right, and there's a photograph in the book by this archaeologist Nelson from about 100 years ago of some kind of figure and all these little ceremonial pots surrounding it, and it was amazing that had survived.
That's the Pueblo Blanco idol, as they call it. Yeah.
What do we know about that? How do you interpret that?
Well, it's one of very few so-called idols that survived because the Spanish smashed them by the hundreds, I guess. I saw it in the Museum of Natural History in New York, where all Nelson's stuff went. It really should come back to New Mexico. But
it should indeed. I mean, seeing that photograph of this thing in context, and then hearing your description of handling it, where it's sitting in a drawer. It's not even displayed. It's sitting in a drawer.
Yeah. And it was such a strange, and that was one of the most moving experiences I had, certainly, about objects in this whole business. But to hold this and know exactly where it came from. And to be able to see the view it would have seen and in my mind and so on. It was quite an experience. But nobody knows much about these things. I mean, they have some idea of medicine of some kind. I mean,
there aren't contemporary people who are using similar things in ways that look like that?
They just don't seem to be. I don't know of any. But there's maybe another thing I don't know.
Well, there may be aspects, too, that we never get a chance to see.
But very few of these small stone idols have turned, I mean, idols, terrible figures, and so on, have turned up. And there are a couple of fakes that were kicking around even in Nelson's time. So people already knew what the museums wanted and were ready to produce them.
You were talking a moment ago about how it's not just the sites that are important, but the whole landscape around them, and some of the text in your book is devoted to describing concentric circles and spirals and things that you have in these sites and in the petroglyphs and so on. And then when the Spanish came and the way that they handled the land was a kind of an imposition of a Euclidean way of thinking on top of a really different, even geometrical and geographical way of thinking. Describe that difference.
Well, the Spanish, they did think very differently. I mean, the laws of the Indies demanded that the towns be built a certain way and so forth, but the settlers weren't very good at doing that. They didn't really pay too much attention to a lot of that. And they were people, a lot of them were mestizos by then, the mixed Indian and Spanish heritage. And they probably knew more, understood the Pueblo way of life much more clearly than any of the upper class did. But they did their suertes, which were long strips that would go from the river up to maybe in Galisteo, the original town, which didn't come in until about 1814. There'd be the house at the top of the hill, and then these long suertes were farming strips, like allotments sort of things, went down to the river and they could take their irrigation off of that. There was a very different system, but they scattered their farms way more than the Spanish wanted them to, and so they were not as defensible as the government and the crown wanted them to be, but they just went ahead and did it. And they were, I mean, the Spanish settlers were raided right up until the 1860s and probably isolated instances after that, so there were raids from the nomadic Indians. So the early settlers. And that's one reason the Galisteo Basin, there was nobody in the Galisteo Basin in 1782 except for when the Tano left. the Tano had been stuffed there to be a buffer between the nomadic tribes and Santa Fe. So they were suffering terribly. They had famine, they had smallpox, they had Comanche raids, and the Spanish wouldn't let them leave, and so they wouldn't give them permission to leave the Pueblo. And the roof of the church was falling in. I mean, it was just a mess. And they finally apparently sort of trickled off into various places, and the last little group left and went to Domingo. But there wasn't anybody else out there. You see dates, totally spurious dates for things in Galisteo. 1703, the inn was supposed to have been built in 1703. You know, nobody was, not even the Indians were back in 1703. They came back in 1706. So it was a vast, empty, dangerous spot to be.
Are there people who still identify themselves as descendants of Tano Indians?
Oh, yeah, but they're not publicly in a funny way. I mean, well, the Tewa village in Hopi comes as close to it, but they call themselves Tewa and not Tano. It's a very, I've got a chapter on that. It's a very complicated story, and I don't think it would make much sense if I just... when they left the basin empty after the revolt, and they built new villages in north of Santa Fe. And when the Spanish came back, they kicked them out of those places, and they were milling around, and then they revolted yet again in 1696. And then in 1697, the idea was to send them back to Galisteo Basin, and they wouldn't go because they knew what they were going to get into, probably. And then in 1706, another governor did send them back, and they were there for that 6 to 82 in very bad shape. I mean,
and is the land used today by any of these folks in any way?
No. There's nobody living there, and in fact, it's very hard to tell if there are little traces of possibility of a Tano person living in Galisteo Village here and there, but it's almost untraceable. And as a Domingo person told me, if you live in Santo Domingo, you speak Karis, and you're Santo Domingo, you are Kiwa now. You are not a Tano anymore. So the people who were there, although that must have come down on some level, but it's not easy to... People don't really want to talk about it.
It's just about time to go. I want to thank both of you for coming in today.
Thank you so much. And I should mention, before we go, my deepest gratitude to the Lannan Foundation. I got a literary award from the Lannan panel in 2000, which really allowed me to write this book. And they have been immensely patient because it took me 10 years after that to get it out.
Well, and great thank you to the Lannan Foundation for everything they do in this community.
Absolutely.
The book is called Down Country, The Tano of the Galisteo Basin, 1250 to 1782. Lucy Lepard is the writer, and Edward Ranney is the photographer. And once again, they will be speaking at a panel discussion and book signing at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture this coming Sunday, the 13th of June, at 3 in the afternoon. And archaeologist Eric Blindman, whom we've had on this show, will also be there. A couple of other people as well?
And Rena Swensel, a Tewa scholar.
Right.
It's from Santa Clara.
And there will also be an event at the Community Center in Galisteo on Saturday, the 26th of June, at 5 in the afternoon. The book is published by the Museum of New Mexico Press. Thanks both for being here.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.